listening to Truth To You with Jono, and I'm speaking today with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, my friend.
Good day, and finally, after several programs, you're actually introducing the program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a moment to remember. Every time I have to remind him what we're doing.
It's not that you remind me, it's just we're always in mid-conversation that we don't want to interrupt with an introduction. Now we've just done an introduction.
Okay. Yeah, we're working introduction this time because we just finished a conversation with something completely not related to what we're talking about today.
Everybody knows your voice. You're a man who needs no introduction. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page that you can like. You go there, Hebrew in Israel. Also, if you would like Hebrew lessons from Yoel, which I highly recommend, it is the email to contact him on is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. That's HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Hey.
Yes, I want to actually thank a lot of people who have been putting likes and sending messages, a lot of positive feedback. So I want to thank here publicly everyone who I know and don't know. I want to thank you guys. I wish I could thank everyone personally, but it's allowing the information to come out there. By every like that people put in, it can be another 100 people to actually see it.
That's right.
Now see the page. So
go to the page. And if anyone comment.
If anyone has any questions, any ideas they want me to talk about, I'll gladly post. You know, I post little short things. I don't know, 100, 200 words each time about a certain subject. If there's anything specific people want to know, I'll gladly either you can send me a message or I can you just post it, then I'll answer. And hopefully you get an answer quickly. Not always doesn't always happen. If you remember, I do have other things I do, which is
work. I don't know how you find the time, particularly when I'm interrupting you all through the week. But today, Hebrew in Israel. It's
actually you'll be surprised. You'll be surprised. You're the one of the least people that interrupt me.
Really?
I get messages. I can be in the middle of working. I'm in the middle of a lesson.
You're a multitasker.
Oh no, you did something last week.
I did. I interrupted you in the middle of a lesson.
I'm working and you're sending me messages in the middle.
You're a multitasker.
I'm working. Leave me alone.
It's a talent that I don't have. I can't multitask. If a fly flies by while I'm talking to you, all of a sudden I'm distracted and I have to start again. Fortunately,
well, like
no
the cows. Fun. You remember the story with the cows?
What happened with the cows?
You send me a message. I'm annoyed with the cows.
Oh.
And what happened? One started mooing and then the whole herd.
Everyone wanted to move. It was like some sort of congregation of cows outside my window. What are we talking about today?
Okay. So I get asked a lot by people specifically come to Israel about Jews in general, different groups inside Judaism and what it means and what it represents. And people keep on confusing different groups and confusing customs and stuff like that. So I want to try, this might be a short one, you never know, but I'm going to try to clarify some of these concepts so people don't get confused. And we might talk about a bit of the history of different groups inside Judaism and a bit of the customs some groups have. And stuff like that.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is you're going to give us an outline of Jews on the Jew spectrum, all the different kinds of Jews, because there's a lot of words. You know, when I think of that, right, I think of words like Ashkenazi. I think of words like Hasidic. I think of there's a lot.
Exactly.
Sephardic. Exactly. And all that sort of stuff. Where do you want to begin?
So where do I want to begin? In the beginning, there was Abraham.
Indeed.
In the beginning, there were no Jews, basically. Mm-hmm. It was Abraham. In time, everyone knows, the groups developed. And first, I want to point out something I noticed is that Jews never called themselves Jews. It came into existence later on when the surrounding neighbors started calling Jews as Jews. Jews always considered themselves as Israelites.
Right.
Now, why did Jews always consider themselves as Israelites? Because there's a few statements in the Bible, specifically in the Book of Kings and Chronicles, that actually points out that other tribes moved from the north. Whoever survived the conquest of Sanherib came to Judea to live in Judea. So it's always been understood that the Judeans, the Jews of Judea, were not just Jews. There were at least another two more tribes in the group.
Sure.
But the understanding is that it's more than that. So I would say that, first of all, when you say Jews, you have to be very, very careful what you're actually saying. Because when you say a Jew, you're actually saying someone who's a Judean. So, for example, for a while there, I used to tell people, I'm not a Jew, I'm a Levite. More as a joke, that's being serious.
Right.
But it's actually true. Now, there's a clear tradition in the Jewish world that the tribe of Benjamin survived inside the Judean people.
Mm-hmm.
Simon survived inside the Judean people.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that Jews are at least four tribes.
Sure.
So we're only really missing eight tribes, or more like nine, because we have Ephraim and Menashe. So Ephraim and Menashe obviously went somewhere. Most of the northern tribes, specifically the most northern ones, for example, it says in Isaiah that Arza Naphtali. So really northern tribes like Naphtali were the first ones to be exiled.
Mm-hmm.
Reuben, Menashe, and Gad. Reuben, Gad, and Menashe, half of Menashe, were obviously exiled unless they were able to flee into Judea.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that there's a good chance. I mean, there's a verse, I think, in Chronicles that says that some people from a few tribes, I mean, I can actually look up the verse. It should be in Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. And it has to do with they actually made the Passover, and it says that some of them actually joined the Judeans because their heart, they surrendered. So it's probably at times of King Hezekiah.
So hang on, let me get this right. Like there is the invasion of Shalmaneser the Fifth, who swoops down and takes Samaria, and the city, and destroys it, and exiles so much of the people. Meanwhile, those who are, I guess, on the peripheral areas are fleeing away from the battle and the turmoil and whatnot, and in any direction, I suppose, that they can safely escape. And clearly, one of those directions is south, and they'd be heading down into Judah. So, but not all of them, I suppose.
So, actually, the verse in Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 30, verse 11, says, "But people from the tribes of Asher, Menashe, and Zvulun, so kind of the word is nichneu, but doesn't mean surrender. It means that they understood that they were wrong, and they actually went to Jerusalem. So there's a good chance even some of them actually stayed in Judea. So again, when you say Jews, you're actually referring to a lot of things, to a lot of people, a lot of groups.
Sure.
So, you know, Jews are not just Judeans. Jews are not just a tribe of Judah. The tribe of Judah was the most dominant one, basically. So first of all, that's the concept of Jews. It was really the Gentiles, the Romans who cycle in this area, Judea, and that's how the name Jews began.
Right, right. Okay? So obviously for a length of time after Shalmaneser, they were able to, they obviously kept their identity. Then Nebuchadnezzar, a couple of hundred years later, exiled to Babylon.
No, but you're missing Sanherib, who was the actual one who destroyed Samaria. Sanherib was the actual king who came here, conquered the northern kingdom, exiled many people. I mean, they slowly, the northern kingdom slowly was broken down until they conquered Samaria. But when you conquer Samaria, it doesn't mean that you exile everyone. You can't really exile everyone. This is why I came up with this theory that now we start with the first other group inside the what we can call the Jewish world or the Israelite world, which is the Samaritans. Okay, so the Samaritans, according to the Book of Chronicles, were nations that came from beyond the river, basically Aramaic-speaking nations who came to this area. And you can see that in Chronicles, I think it's, sorry, not Chronicles, it's in Kings, 1 Kings chapter 22, somewhere in that area, where he talks about the nations that he brought. And actually, there's something which was discovered that Sanherib writes that he brought nations from that place and put them here. Yes. It doesn't mean that they were all, that all the Samaritans all were from this group. And also what it mentions is that they brought a Kohen, a priest, to go and teach them the Torah. Yes. That's a very interesting thing because they have a copy of the Torah, which is slightly different than ours, but it's extremely similar. I mean, I would say there's like 6,000 or 7,000 differences, but sometimes we're talking about differences of consonants, not something too serious. But the text itself as a whole is very, very similar to ours.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. So we actually have a record from the first temple period of people who have a Torah way before King Josiah, and probably something like 100 years before King Josiah.
Mm-hmm.
So that completely topples the whole idea that he invented the Book of Deuteronomy, sure, for example. Completely topples the whole idea that Ezra was written in the Second Temple period. No, the Torah was well established at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The versions, again, the Samaritan version of Torah is adjustments that they made. There's places where you can see that it's an ideological adjustment, or it's an adjustment they made because they didn't understand the language correctly.
Okay.
But again, I'm not saying that the Torah, the version that we have is like literally this is what Moses passed down. We know this is a fact that it wasn't because they had to adjust it throughout the Second Temple period. There's this whole story that they found three Torah scrolls in the temple when they got rid of the Greeks, and there were variations in between them. So the canonization of the Torah itself is very, 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 very early, probably from the times of Moses, but mistakes were made. So I can't even, if we discover a Torah scroll from the times of Moses and we see differences, let's not stand there and say, oh, Gevalt, what happened? No, I personally will not go into shock.
Sure.
So we have the Samaritans, and the Samaritans are a group who live in Samaria. They actually live just next to Nablus. They have one village there, and then they have another village in Cholon. I personally consider them part of the Israelite people because they do believe in the God of Israel. They do believe in the Torah of Moses. Mm-hmm. They just have it wrong on where the temple should be. That's all.
Okay.
So that's another group that developed. Now, originally, there were no different sects in Judaism. No, there was just Israelites, and they practiced this one Torah that was given to them by Moses, and that's what they did.
Right.
The problem starts with diasporas. And when you have a diaspora, you can develop customs.
Now, let me just ask you one question before we go there. When you say they practiced their religion was the Torah, and now you say they weren't, originally they're not referred to as Jews, they referred to themselves as Israelites, so therefore is it fair to say they didn't refer to their religion as Judaism, right?
Of course, yeah. The name Judaism as well. I mean, for example, if you open up the Mishnah, in the Tractate of Ketubot, which talks about marriage agreements and what a man owes to his wife, etc., there's an interesting Mishnah that I think it's in chapter 7 or something like that, that says that a woman who, the covering of a woman's hair is what's called Dat Moshe, the law of Moses. And the extra cover that women wore, which was like a shawl, is Dat Yehudit. And it was always referred as Dat Israel or Dat Moshe, or Ish Israeli, they never referred to them as Jews. It was never looked at as being Jews. Now, by the way, if you look at the book of Judith, it actually mentions that they were the main characters in the book of Judith. Judith were actually from the tribe of Simon, Shimon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that simple to say that all Jews are just Judeans. It's not that simple to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see in different places where it talks about, I never saw in the Mishnah, you can find the Mishnah here and there, but for example, the Mishnah being from around the second century, you don't see this concept of Yehudi that dominant. It's a lot, in a lot of cases, you see the word Israeli.
Sure.
Or Ben Israel, the son of Israel. So it was really Gentiles, and probably mostly from the Christian period when they started calling Jews. Because Christians were going to say we are the Israel replacement theology.
Sure.
So it might have
to break the difference. They're referring to the Jewish religion as Judaism, distinctly different from what's going on there.
Exactly. And Judaism in the Jewish mindset is not the Torah. I mean, today it is, but originally it wasn't the Torah. It was the custom of the Jews. What was customary amongst Jews. So it has nothing to do with the law of Moses. It has to do with customs. And this is why the word Dat Yehudit doesn't necessarily mean the law of Jews, but the custom of Jews.
Okay.
So we have that. Now, diaspora, a lot of nations, not too many nations have actually been in diaspora. There's a very few nations that have been in the diaspora. The Tibetans have been in the diaspora. Obviously, the Jews have been in a diaspora. And there are very, very few nations that actually did this. So what happens in a diaspora? Why is a diaspora such a terrible thing? It creates separate groups. Now, today in the age of internet and cell phones and everything, so it's easy to stay in touch. You know, a rabbi in the U.S. can have a discussion with a rabbi in Jerusalem, and they can agree on things. Originally, there was a responsa. No, you ask a question, it takes 6 months until a letter arrives.
Sure.
The person might be dead by then.
Sure.
So people developed small pockets of communities around the world, creating different groups, causing it to look like as if there's some kind of a separation between the groups in custom, in practice of Torah, and it did. You know, if you open up, for example, the one of the responses I saw was there was a community which was considered to be a rabbinic community, and I'm about to go into that issue as well. It was a rabbinic community which had practices very similar to Karaites, but they were considered to be rabbinic. So let's now go into another phase. In the Second Temple period, people started arguing over what is truth and the shock of being in a exile and everything. And there were three main groups which are mentioned in Josephus. And actually, one of the groups, Josephus, is one of the only sources we actually have about this group.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Pharisees, which, according to Josephus, was 6,000 people. They held of the concept of an oral law, which was slightly different from what we see as oral law today in Rabbinic Judaism. Mm-hmm. But they were the founding fathers of the concept of oral law in the Law of Moses. You had the Sadducees, which we have very, very few laws from them. They were very interesting, but they held by only doing what the Torah says, but they were not similar to the Karaites. They mm-hmm. were not exactly the same group. They, for example, didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. They didn't believe really in any kind of afterlife. They were not really, they were probably spiritual, but very, very mechanic as well.
Okay.
One book I read that is that they treated God almost as if he was some kind of like pagan god, because they treated as if the God is a dynamic being that you have to fear all the time, and as if he's always like watching you, and he might lose his temper with you and stuff like that. But it looked as if the Pharisees looked at God as more of a static God. And there was a difference in philosophy, but we don't know much about the Sadducees. The ones we know even less about are the Essenes. Okay, the Essenes were some kind of group, according to Josephus, were 4,500 people, maybe related to the people living in Qumran. It's not 100% sure. They might have been some kind of an offshoot from the Essenes. We're not too sure. Mm-hmm. And what they believed in and what they practiced is not very clear to us either, except for a point where it does look like as if they didn't really have an oral law on the same level that rabbinic or Pharisees had.
Okay.
They had a bit of it, maybe none of it. We're not too sure. So those were three groups. Now, the Essenes more or less vanished. The Essenes and Sadducees more or less vanished when Jerusalem was destroyed, because what happened was that the main characters in the Jewish world at the time were actually Pharisees. They were most beloved by the people. This is a quote from Josephus. He says, because they were nicer to the people, they were more open towards the public, and they tended to be more down to earth. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones who attended the synagogues and were involved with communities. And so they were the ones who were in charge when the temple was destroyed, and they were the ones who were able to get up. There was a rabbi called Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He got up, went out to the Romans, said, give me a city called Yavne and let me go. And he gives it. He gives them the city called Yavne, and that's how Judaism survived. But even when Judaism survived, they the ones who didn't believe in the oral law still existed. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they vanished. It's just they downtoned, seriously downtoned. So you see in the Talmud, in different places where they mention a character called an Am Haaretz, a man, a native of the land, or a man of the land. Usually an Am Haaretz in terminology of Hebrew is just a simpleton, the person who's like, doesn't know anything. But when you see these simpletons, these so-called simpletons, these are people who actually know the Bible very, very well. So I came up with this understanding, and I don't think I'm the first one who came up with this. I remember talking with Nehemiah about this, and he kind of approved of it, that the Am Haaretz mentioned in the Talmud is really the ones who didn't believe in the oral law and didn't really heed to rabbis. But they were presented as Am Haaretz, trying to say, oh, these are boorish people. They don't have this oral law that we have that allows us to know these special secrets.
Can I ask you a question? Because in the tradition that I came from, we would often hear it, it being spoken about the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes. What is the New Testament referring to when it talks about the scribes? Do you know?
Scribes? I don't know if there's – maybe the scribes were the Essenes, because the Essenes were very, very big on writing books. They were very big about – probably very big about writing scrolls and stuff like that. Maybe the Essenes were the class of the scribes. Maybe. I really don't know.
Okay.
Could be. Maybe. I don't know. So basically when the Karaites came to existence, when Anan ben David, the so-called founder of the Karaite movement, he was revered by the Karaites as being the founder, but they all say he wasn't really a Karaite, because he did have a lot of very, very strange opinions, some of them really off the wall.
Okay.
And there's a few opinions I've seen from his book that are really off the wall. Like, for example, the Passover, if the time of the Passover comes out on a Friday night when Shabbat's supposed to start, then we postpone the Passover to the next night so we don't have to defile the Shabbat. So he decides that we're moving the whole thing by one day, stuff like that. So okay. That's kind of off. But when he developed the group, there was he called out. He was the son of the head of the diaspora, and he called out anyone who doesn't believe in the oral law, come to me. And they did. So he didn't just run around converting people to his beliefs. He called up the people who actually did not believe in the oral law. So I kept on saying to people, you know, everything that we know about Jewish history, a lot of the stuff we know about Jewish history, was actually diluted or seen through the eyes of the rabbis and not the eyes of what really happened in history. Sure. So I keep on pointing that out to people, and it's very, very important we understand that. So he started off the movement itself. There were different stages with different groups inside this kind of Karaite movement. But probably only around the 8th or 9th century really was their established movement. A lot of them moved to Jerusalem. They established a synagogue here, which is still in existence. And they had the 10th, 11th century was the time when Karaism really developed, and most of the writings come from that period. Mm-hmm. And Karaites still exist to this very day. We have the old famous Nehemiah Golden, but we also have more traditional Karaites, Egyptian Karaites. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Most of them were in the area of Israel, you know, from Syria, Turkey, Persia. Not too many Karaites in Europe. I mean, there's Crimean Karaites, which were probably mostly came from Turkey. It's interesting that there weren't too many of them in Europe or North Africa. It's quite interesting that they never reached that area. Mm. Today, the group itself, I mean, there's about, they say, between 35 to 40,000 people in the Karaite movement. I mean, people were born as Karaites. I don't know about extra people, which are not counted into the communities, you know, people who were not born of even Jewish descent to see themselves as Karaite. But essentially, that was one of the big famous splits that happened. But the Karaites today, you know, everyone's trying to say the Karaites don't really exist. The first time I met a Karaite, like, I knew the existence of Karaites, but it was always taught in school they don't really exist. Mm-hmm. There may be a few of them left, but they don't really exist. And then you discover there's a whole bunch of them.
There's a whole lot of them. And we understand that the Karaites, of course, are those who just hold to the Tanakh solely without acknowledging the Talmud. Yes and no,
because if you open up a Karaite book, a traditional Karaite writing, there's a lot of stuff that really clings to the actual meaning of the words, and there are places where they have their own new interpretation. There's a few stuff that I've seen throughout the years from reading books that I've noticed that you're not exactly what the Torah says. Mm. But yes, this is why, for example, there's a movement now, what's called narrow Karaites, which are basically Karaites who are going back to the original concept of following Torah based literally on Torah itself, very similar to some people.
Okay, you know? So neo-Karaites. So is that to be understood in the same way that
people call them? Some people call them neo-Karaites, some people call them Karaites. I don't really have any names. I just know, look at them as Jews. I don't really care about these names. But so that's one of the major splits that happened. Now, in time, obviously, Jews scattered all over. You have Jews from different places, from North Africa, from Europe, but that doesn't define anything. Mm-hmm. You know, if you come from North Africa, if you come from Morocco, Tunisia, wherever it is, you come to the land of Israel, okay, so you have your traditions, you have your slightly different prayer book, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's not considered to be a major split. You know, it's just you come from different areas. But there was a major split in Europe. In the 1700s, Jews started looking into what's called Kabbalah. Now, some people call it Kabbalah. In the English accent.
Sure.
And what it did, it created an interesting effect in Europe. In North African countries, because they came from Arab countries, having mysticism, some kind of magic and stuff, it wasn't too strange because it didn't have the Renaissance in these areas. So science wasn't the big thing and still isn't. A lot of these countries are full of superstition. Mm-hmm. So for them to receive these writings of the Zohar and the Kabbalah and everything wasn't too peculiar for them. So there was no splits. There were only two places where there were massive splits. I'll talk about the short one very, very quickly, and then I'll go to Europe.
Sure.
In Yemen, in the late 1800s, and I actually met the great-grandson of the person who started this movement.
Really?
A lot of the Kabbalistic writings, I actually met someone who knew, as a child, knew the man who started this movement. And it was a movement called the Dardaim. And it's basically based on the idea of the word Dor Dea. Now, the word Darda appears as one of the wise men I think it's about Solomon, that his wisdom was greater than Darda, which is probably a name of some character who was a very wise person. Mm-hmm. And they were called the Dor De'ah, the generation of knowledge, and they were anti-Kabbalists. When the Kabbalah arrived in Yemen, they actually fought against it. Now, they never won. It was no actual war. There was a short, very, very several-year war, and then it just died out. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people who come from the capital of Sana'a, for example, who are very anti-Kabbalah. So that's one kind of a split that happened. Sure. The bigger split that happened is actually in Europe, which was the split of the Hasidut. So that's what we have the word Hasidim from.
Right. Okay. This is what I want to know about. Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at Judaism today, very, very briefly, we have a lot of secular Jews, unfortunately. But a lot of these secular Jews, specifically in here in Israel, identify Orthodox Judaism as being Judaism, or basically Judaism actually follows and practices Torah. On the other hand, in the 1700s, they started, several movements started. One of them was the Reform Movement. Mm-hmm. Which was basically a group of Jews from Germany who wanted to start attending the universities. Now, this is related also to the fact that at the time there were Germans who wanted to learn Hebrew and see the Bible in Hebrew. So mm-hmm. The Hebrew Roots movement today is not something new. It's just a revival, something every once in a while pops up amongst believers in the New Testament, believers in Yeshua. Mm-hmm. And these Germans were fascinated with Judaism, started learning Hebrew, reading the Bible in Hebrew, and that created some kind of an interesting relationship with Jews who obviously also knew at least a level of reading Hebrew from the mm-hmm. Bible, mm-hmm. and they started connecting. So the Jews developed, they were rejected by the Germans because the Germans were anti-Semitic, were Jew haters, mm-hmm. so they developed their own academy, and it was called the Bildung, and they started creating the status of academic Jews in time because of the academy and also being exposed to different theories about the Bible and everything. And Wilhausen, they started developing this new movement called the Reform Movement, or the Reformed Movement, that basically said Judaism is just a I would say almost like a country club. It was basically Judaism was some kind of a status of society, was a social economic status, mm-hmm. and was not a religion anymore.
So was this an attempt to in some way modernize and make relevant Judaism to the greater population? Is that possibly what it was? To make it more palatable in the modern age in which they lived?
In the beginning, no. It was just basically Jews who kind of like started saying, hey, we don't really believe in the Torah. And at least some of them were. There were more extreme people, less extreme people.
So we don't necessarily, we're not very religious when it comes to the Torah, but we do want to maintain a level of our cultural identity.
There were ones who actually said, okay, we can convert to Christianity and still call ourselves Jews. And they were. There was one guy, I can't remember his name now, he was very extreme in his opinions. He actually went and converted. He converted to Christianity, abandoned Judaism completely, abandoned the Torah completely, and said, okay, I am a Jew, and he officially said he's Jewish, mm-hmm. but he's a believer in Jesus. But he abandoned everything. He wouldn't follow Torah at all.
So would he not be referred to as an apostate Jew?
Yes and no. It's a bit different because his conversion to Christianity wasn't really from belief. It was from this idea that if he converts, then the Gentiles would accept him. That was, I think, really the mindset behind it. It had nothing to do with really believing in Jesus.
Okay.
So that's the Reform Movement. There were different offshoots of it, different opinions. There was a break at one point somewhere in the late 1800s or early 1900s where some Reform rabbis basically said, well, we've gone completely overboard. Mm-hmm. We're rabbis, and these people actually knew, unlike the Reform rabbis of today, Reform Movement today is nothing like it was 200 years ago, 100 years ago. 100 years ago, though these people maybe didn't follow Torah, they actually knew Torah. They mm-hmm. knew Talmud. They knew the Bible. Mm-hmm. They knew them. They knew everything. They didn't come out of ignorance. Today, most Reform rabbis, you know, I'm hearing these courses that they're giving people for conversion. There's nothing there. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mother went to meet up with a Reform rabbi. My mother knew more than this man did, and my mother's not a rabbi or anything. She was never trained, but she's sat and she's read and stuff like that. And so today it's like, it's literally today, you go to a Reform synagogue, it's almost a country club.
Mm.
It's you go to it because you have some socioeconomic identity. You're the Jews of the area.
Sure.
The children don't have any knowledge of Torah. You know, this place, you got people who say they don't even believe in God. Look,
you and I have had discussions about this. I came to you whinging and moaning about my experiences in a Reformed synagogue, and we tried the kids out in
the Torah lesson, the Talmud Torah.
Yeah.
Number the cheder.
Cheder, that's the word I'm thinking of. Yeah. And so
the word cheder means a room. It's the word cheder. But they use it as, they call it cheder because it meant a room where the children sit and study.
So there they are.
My father went to cheder as a child.
Look, and at the time I thought this is a great idea. And so I thought, you know, the kids will get a little bit more immersion into Jewish life and meet some people and this and that. It'll be great. And lo and behold, during the – we won't go into detail here, but during – one of the lessons, I think this was my daughter, and the teacher said, now, is anyone here not believe in God? And a whole bunch of the kids put up their hand. And then another one put up their hand and said, oh, I do believe in God, but I do eat pig. And my daughter is going, what am I doing here? What am I doing here?
But this get me is the out, get me out.
Yeah, it was. And we, yeah,
but that's exactly what it is. That's the problem. So it's problem. No longer, you know, an identity also relating to the issue of a covenant with God. It's now a covenant of us amongst ourselves.
Mm.
And there were a lot of writers that spoke about this, that really the Torah is really, you know, the main issue of the Torah is the relationship between human beings and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't work like that, because the whole idea of the Torah is to say, yes, but I am God, which means if you commit atrocities against one another, you have to answer to me.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not going to be doing it, I'm still watching over what's going on here. They don't understand that. Mm. It's a covenant of a nation being a nation, but also God with God. That's how the Torah really works.
And that really messed with my head, because I had to deal with the concept of the quote cultural Jew. I didn't understand. But then it dawned on me, you know, even in the tradition that I came from, you know, growing up in the Christian church, there were plenty of cultural Christians that would turn up on Easter and Christmas and not really on the Sundays, you know, and it's a similar thing.
Exactly. And from these types of people, because they don't really understand dynamics of being a nation, because they're scattered wherever they are, you have raging leftists, self-hating Jews, and this is what it develops into. So as a lecturer I heard once said, the moment you start moving away from Torah, the atrocities begin.
Mm.
So when you start moving away from God and replacing God with your own idol, which can be social, economic, society, whatever it would be, replacing it with liberalism or whatnot, or even within a religion of your state, being a very patriotic person to a point where you say that my state takes over my Torah.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That's when the atrocities begin, because basically what happens is that you don't have this understanding that there's someone above you. And that's one of the things, that's one of the points of the Torah. It says, don't do X, Y, Z, don't cheat one another, I am the Lord your God.
Mm.
Why is it saying that statement? It's saying that statement for a very simple reason. You do that, you answer to me.
That's right, because it carries his authority, and when there's no recognition of the greater authority, then that's when the problems begin.
Exactly. So we have the Reformed movement, and then we have a break off from that called the Conservative movement. Basically, a group of Reformed rabbis who decided that the Reformed movement is no longer what it should be, because they're not scholars and not following anything. And specifically, the story I heard, which Nehemiah told me, which is quite a surprise for me, was it what's called the Treif banquet or something like that. I have to ask Nehemiah again. Where they basically said, there was a group of rabbis, and they said, okay, we're going to do this meeting, this annual meeting that they have, annual gathering, and there were a few rabbis there who did want to keep kosher, and they said, can you make sure the food is kosher? So they served shrimp as a first course, and they got up and they walked up to the organizers and said, listen, we asked for Jewish food, for kosher food. So they said, well, the caterer is Jewish. He said, but this is not kosher.
Oh.
And they got up and they developed the Conservative movement, which are hanging somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
You technically, I think most of them do believe in God, and there's stuff that they practice, but they're very liberal about certain things. If they don't feel like it, they won't do it. That's mm-hmm. one of the things I've noticed about them. So they're a lot more respectful of Jewish traditions. They practice a lot of things. They're a lot of things a lot more knowledgeable. I mean, there's this one guy I know, really, really nice guy, who belongs to a conservative movement, who's an actual scholar. He actually knows.
Mm-hmm.
I sit and speak with him, and we really enjoy our conversations because he actually knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He's not inventing things. He's not making up things. You know, I remember standing at this funeral house, and this man said, let's say Kaddish. Kaddish is what's called usually called the mourner's prayer.
Sure.
And we as being the Orthodox members of the group, said, you can't say Kaddish. There's no 10 adult men. Even if you put the women together, there's no 10 people here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but if there's 10 people in the area, and I'm looking at going like, so what's the point of gathering together if we're just going to be scattered? You know, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also not the rules of how you say a Kaddish.
Sure.
So that's kind of like what the conservative are like. They can make up things because they have an emotion at the point. But you have a genuine scholars amongst them who actually know what they're doing. So they're a lot better than the Reform. The Reform is like, I usually call them the Reform Church because it's really far-fetched of being really anything to do with the Torah.
Sure.
So that's another split that happened. Unfortunately, that happens because you distance yourself from Torah. But what do you do if you have a group that doesn't distance itself from Torah and still develops an unusual mindset?
Mm-hmm.
In Europe in the 1700s, it became very popular to study Kabbalah. If you remember, we spoke about that
yes.
about 10, 15 minutes ago. And by the way, I want to clarify something. Besides the Reform and Conservative movements, all the groups that follow Torah are able to be together. It's the Reform and Conservative, because they've broken off of Torah, that they don't want to follow Torah, they've literally put themselves aside.
Sure.
But if you walk, you can walk into any type of synagogue here in Israel, maybe Hasidic, Litvish, North African, whatever it would be, mm-hmm. you will always see people there from different groups. It's very rare that you walk into a Moroccan synagogue and there's only Moroccans there.
Right.
It's extremely rare. I mean, for example, my in-laws live in a place and there's the Moroccan synagogue, and really they have Yemenites there. There's European Jews who go there. It's mixed. No one really cares.
Because the one thing that unites them and that they all agree on is that we uphold the Torah, right?
Exactly.
And so they accept each other. Even though there's some differences here and there, they accept each other
exactly.
because on that major point. Okay.
Exactly. So I would say, and I will dare say this, it's very, very different from the Christian groups.
Mm-hmm.
You have Christian groups. Each person develops his own church. That's it. You don't believe as we believe. That's it. You're outside of our church. Here, it doesn't matter. People don't care. You go whatever single, because everyone follows the Torah. It mm-hmm. unites everyone. You can have disagreements. You can have arguments in between groups. You can have sometimes miniature wars in between groups. But essentially, at the end, people unite. It's not
sure.
People don't remember this forever.
Sure.
So in the 1700s, they started having these groups of people called the Baalei Shem, people who have the name. Now, I'm not too sure exactly why they called the Baalei Shem. Maybe it had to do with the issue of knowing the name of God. But mm-hmm. these were mostly secret Kabbalists. You have to remember, in Europe, the Kabbalah wasn't that popular.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, it's not that popular amongst traditional Ashkenazi or European Jews. So Ashkenaz, first of all, is a name which appears in the book of Genesis, in the genealogy of the son of Yefet. And Ashkenaz basically is referred to Germany, okay?
Uh-huh.
So European Jews are usually called Ashkenazim, but it's not that accurate because not all Jews of Europe came from Germany.
Sure.
A lot of Jews of Europe came from France,
Russia.
From England, Russia was later on. But the German Jews, it was kind of a joke that went on, the German Jews, some of them came from Italy, according to Dr. Zussmann, who wrote books about European Jewish history. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book about the early Ashkenazi rabbis, and he points out a lot of the German Jews came from Italy. So a lot of the Italian Jews came from the land of Israel. So these are Jews that can actually probably say, okay, our ancestors came from the Second Temple period, straight from the land of Israel to Rome. That's a possibility, but there were Jews in France, for example, in the Second Temple period.
So let me just ask you this question. Sorry, just to clarify, what does Ashkenazi mean? What is again?
So the ending, the E ending, basically means one who is from Ashkenaz.
Okay, and Ashkenaz is an area of Germany. Is this what you're saying?
It's basically Germany, but mostly South Germany.
Uh-huh.
Zussmann actually writes that there was a joke amongst German Jews that they used to say Germany is ours because at the time most of northern Germany was not populated.
Right.
And it was the first republic in northern Germany were Jews, yeah.
Sure.
At least according to Zussmann.
Uh-huh.
So what happened was that these little pockets of Kabbalist European Jews started teaching these. And there was one individual who was called the Baal Shem Tov. So he wasn't just a Baal Shem, he was called Baal Shem Tov, the one with the good name.
Mm-hmm.
Tov is good. And he presumably, and when you look a bit into the way it's written, presumably started the Hasidic movement. The word Hasid, okay, essentially appears in the book of Tehillim, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, King David calls himself a Hasid. And a Hasid basically means a pious person.
Mm-hmm.
They were very far away from being pious in the beginning, and they're not very pious these days either. The whole idea of the Hasidut in the beginning was, and this is from a researcher friend of mine and I did quite a while back, that his original message was just be happy. You know, being in Europe, suffering the Crusades, suffering pogroms, European Jews are pretty miserable most of the time. And the main idea of what he was trying to say was we have to achieve happiness. If we're sad, it's basically a disadvantage because we can't connect to the divine. It's like basically taking the idea of King Saul, and when he was sad, you know, God basically removed off of him, and he's sad. So by trying to be happy, we're trying to bring back God into our lives. And by the way, when you're happier, I would say something very funny. If when you're happier, your energy is a lot higher, a lot of people relate to as if your spirits become stronger.
In martial arts,
we call it development of what's called the ki or the chi, depends which mindset you want to go through.
To be happy, the pursuit of happiness, to me, that says hedonism. Hedonism is something that you often hear about in Christian circles as well. And it's defined as the pursuit of pleasure, or I have in front of me the ethical theory that pleasure is the highest good and proper aim of human life. Would that be, in a nutshell, what you're talking about?
Yes and no. It wasn't as if the happiness was an ideal. It did become an ideal at one point. And that's how things started going haywire with them. It's not really that the ideal is to be happy. It's just to, when you worship God, it's like Ivdu et Hashem besimcha. There's a verse in Tehillim that says, "Work or worship God with happiness." Bo lefanav birnana, come before Him with a song. So that was the idea, you know. Don't go to synagogue and just, if you ever see a Jewish, you go to synagogue and the people are waving there, and there's no. We're worshiping God. This is not as if we're coming in front of Him because we're praying, you know, God save us from X, Y, Z. Okay, that'd be logical. Ripping our clothing and putting ashes on our heads and stuff like that. Actually, it says in one place, Kir'u levavchem ve'al bigdechem. It says, rip to your heart, not your clothing. Mm. It's more of an internal thing.
Mm.
But the whole idea is that when you go to synagogue, you know, make songs and be happy and everything. That was the original idea. Okay. The problem is that after him, we're not too sure if he was really the founder of Hasidut, did it actually already exist. But in time, a lot of people say sweeping into it, and they put aside the study of Torah and were more involved in the issue of being happy. There's even someone who said that they were involved in using drugs of sorts. There's one book I saw called Hasidut of Cannabis.
Oh.
Someone said they were smoking weed or something like that. I'm not too sure about that, but the whole idea was basically they started breaking off of Judaism. They were breaking off of practicing Torah, and they reached a point where it really went mad.
Truly.
It went completely off the wall. And there were people who were not following Torah. People were doing things which are completely forbidden.
Now, is this in conjunction with the study of Kabbalah as well?
And this was in conjunction with the study of Kabbalah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Because they put aside the practice of Torah, and there was horrendous cases. You know, people by Torah law had to be executed.
Goodness me!
You know,
because that's a very,
like that.
Very different picture to the general picture of, or the stereotypical picture of the Hasidic movement today, right?
Yeah. So there's, yeah, it's true, but that's something happened at one point.
Mm.
There's actually a book called Hasidim u'Mitnagdim. The word Hasidim, we had the word Hasidim, which means the Hasidim, the pious people, presumably pious, and then we had the people. Now, I'm not saying it was everyone, by the way. To be very, very clear, there were a lot of them which were not. But the war began, the war against them began when these horrendous cases started coming up, coming into light. And there's actually this two-volume book that is about all the writings, or many of the writings written in the 1700s about what was going on. Actual eyewitness cases mm-hmm. of people who were there who saw what happened. I actually read through the two volumes of this book, and it was fascinating to read, but also pretty horrific. You wouldn't imagine when you go to a Hasidic group today. I was like, they're very, very strict. I mean, they're strict to a point where it's mad. You know, women shaving their heads and not eating matzot with any liquid next to it because it might ferment and stuff like that.
Hey.
In the beginning, it wasn't like that. In the beginning, it was the movement of the simpletons and of the ones who knew who didn't want to follow Torah. And so, in time, it was adjusted. So at one point in the late 1700s, sort of rabbi who was called the Baal HaTanya, who started the movement of Chabad. And right. He was referred as the Litvak. Now, what is a Litvak? The Litvak is basically a person from Lithuania, because mm-hmm. Hasidim mostly sprouted in Eastern Europe. So there's a lot of Polish Jews or Hasidim, mm-hmm. There's Romanian, though in Romania it was split. There were a lot of Romanian Jews who were Hasidim, and a lot which were anti. In Russia, at one point, it actually reached Russia as well. But there was a split, and there was actual war that went on. And there were rabbis who wrote severe letters about it. They even wanted to create a rabbinical court to denounce them and remove them from the Jewish people. Say that they're not Jewish anymore, and you can't marry them.
Wow.
You can't marry them. They can't attend synagogue because it was completely – a lot of them went completely against Torah. They did horrendous things. And I don't want to – I'm emphasizing it because it was pretty bad.
Sure.
But then Baal HaTanya came in, and thank God he came in, because what he did was very, very important. He got a hold of every – not literally, but he started writing against their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the one that we can give him the credit of readjusting the Hasidic movement and bringing them back.
So it was like a reformation at the time, right?
Exactly. He took care of it, and many of these people repented. They realized they were wrong.
Mm.
There are stories of these people that literally went down on their knees in front of rabbinic courts crying, saying, "We're sorry, we made a mistake," and they were accepted back.
Mm-hmm.
They were accepted back. These people just, you know, they were misled. So today, I mean, when you say a Hasid, I'm probably boring people to death here.
No, I'm really interested in this, because what I want to ask you is, like, I know that there is the Hasidic movement, but how is that – what I want to know is, how does that differ? Because we understand – listeners know that there is the Orthodox, there is the ultra-Orthodox, but how does the Hasidic fit into that?
Okay, so today – we have Reform Conservative, we spoke about them. We have Orthodox, which is what I grew up in, which basically means you're a religious Jew. You don't have any specific ideologies. You don't believe. You don't belong to some specific group. You don't dress in a specific way. Mm-hmm. You have a yarmulke on your head. You wear tzitzit. You do everything. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the Orthodox are also considered to be Zionists. Not everyone, but a lot of them, what's called regular Orthodox, are considered to be Zionists, while the ultra-Orthodox are considered to be anti-Zionist.
Really?
But when the Zionist, yes, the Zionist movement originally, the people who started the building of the land of Israel, and here's the big surprise, were ultra-Orthodox Jews. The first farmers in the land of Israel
mm-hmm.
were people who had long beards and worked for a living.
Hey, you like
this,
long beards.
This beard. Thing, long beards, dressed in the kapota, which is the black thing, black long coat that European Jews wore with a black yarmulke on their head, and they went to the field, took the kapota off, took whatever tool they need, and started walking the fields.
Mm-hmm.
Pardes Chana was originally an ultra-Orthodox village. Petach Tikva, a lot of the first groups to come here, basically from 1882 all the way to 1912, 1913,
mm-hmm.
Well, the first three major moves from Europe into land of Israel were ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Right.
The break-off from the Zionist movement started when people like Herzl and Katzenelson and whoever you want and people who Katzenelson and Sokolov, and there was a whole bunch of them that married Gentile women and didn't practice on everything. And these people... these secular people mm-hmm. took over the Zionist movement because there was money in it. There was a lot of money involved in it because people were donating money.
Sure.
So they took over. And this is why, for example, Rabbi Kalischel, you find a Rabbi Kalischel who was an ultra-Orthodox Jew, wrote his whole book called Shivat Zion, The Return to Zion, which was a whole thing about returning to land and living in the land of Israel. The Chafetz Chaim, one of the big symbols of the ultra-Orthodox world, told people, leave Europe. He actually warned them. He used to tell people towards the end of his life, he actually would tell people, I think he died somewhere in, what was it, 1917? I'm not too sure when he died. No, way before that, I think. He would sit there and people would come in to speak with him, to take advice and everything. And then he would look at them and say to them, "Utzion tiyeh lefleta," and Zion will be a refugee, a place of refuge. Mm-hmm. And people would understand what he meant. He'd look at them and say, leave, go back to the land of Israel. He warned people. And later on, people realized what he meant. He knew something was coming.
Yeah.
It's one of these scary stories. And I actually spoke with a person whose grandfather, I think, was told by the Chafetz Chaim to do that. And he did. He left Europe.
Wow.
They came to Israel, and that's how they survived the Holocaust. He knew something was coming. It's shocking. It's a shocking story. But there are a lot of witnesses to this, hundreds of people, that he said that to them. And so really, ultra-Orthodox Jews are, first of all, seen as anti-Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
You also have very, very extreme groups, which are very, very anti-Zionist. But when you say ultra-Orthodox, you're basically referring to the people who are wearing black clothing, hats, suits, mm-hmm. whatever you
want. Black and whites.
But inside these groups, you also have Hasidim.
Right.
And what's called Litvaks, which are basically the ones who do not follow Hasidic Judaism.
Uh-huh. Okay. So ultra-Orthodox are made up of a number of groups as well, and the Hasidic groups.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. so you know, when you have a Litvish Jew, you're just dealing with an ultra-Orthodox Jew. So I want to expand a bit about the issue with the Hasidim. I know I've poorly bored everyone here with this whole history.
No, keep going. Be thorough.
But and I probably this one's going to have probably the least people listening to. But when we talk about the Hasidim, there's a few prominent groups.
Mm.
There's a lot of little groups here and there. Like, I know you have large ones, like, for example, Gur, which is considered one of the most biggest and most powerful. You have Satmel, which is considered to be the most anti-Zionist group. There are a lot of them in America and New York.
Mm-hmm.
A very peculiar thing about the Satmel is they won't speak Hebrew and they barely speak English. So amongst themselves, it's mostly Yiddish. Which is basically, mm-hmm. it's a German dialect, which was from around the 10th century, adopted by Jews. They always make jokes about Hungarian Jews. You guys.
Mm.
You, Jono.
Be nice to the Hungarian Jews.
That they don't speak Yiddish, they speak Hungarian.
Mm-hmm. Which in itself is one of the most bizarre languages on all the earth.
It is very bizarre. Yeah, if you ever, you know, just look at Hungarian news, is really, it's actually related to Turkish. This is part of the issue.
I tell people, you think it's related to Turkish? You know, there's a lot of similarities to Danish. If you take a bunch of syllables and you drop them down the stairs, the sound of them falling is Hungarian.
No, they usually say it's Chinese. I think I read a study once quite a while back that
Japanese. Remember reading, there's some similarities to Japanese as well. It's bizarre.
Yeah, but they say it's closely related to Turkish.
Okay. Oh, because the Ottoman Empire came through. There are things there. Yeah.
Some of the classic ones that everyone knows. So, for example, how do you identify a Hasid? Usually, they all have beards. While Litvish Jews, some of them actually shave. And they all have those side lock called peot.
Peot, yeah.
Small. So actually, first of all, you should know, all European Jews originally either had long hair. Well, people had long hair in the mm-hmm. beginning. Jews of Europe had long hair. And then the Puritans came and became popular for men to have short hair.
Mm-hmm.
So when European Jews trimmed their hair, they made sure they don't remove the sides. Because it says in Leviticus
19:27.
Exactly. Lo takif be'at roshecha. So they went to the extreme. So part of the idea of being Hasidic is to take sometimes today, where they're a lot more strict and they're a lot more observant of things, is to take things with more an extreme.
Mm. Mm.
So for example, it says not to shave the sides of your head. We're not going to shave them at all. So they grow these peot. Many of them grow very long beards, except for example, American Hasidim have a tendency to sometimes trim their beards to make them look nicer. Because many of them are actually business people. They actually have work.
Yeah.
They have businesses. Which is kind of funny because a lot of people here in Israel, for example, look at Haredim, look at ultra-Orthodox, and say, all these people leech off the state. And it's not true. There's a lot of Haredim that work. There's a lot of Haredi businesses. And specifically outside of Israel, you got people who work in everything. Mm-hmm. I saw pictures of paper factories. A lot of them work in diamonds. A lot of businessmen. You know, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not that. You know, it's not that. They're not sitting around doing absolutely nothing. They're actually very good workers, many of them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you ever go to you're a Hasidic group that, you know, for example, they sit in yeshiva, or the yeshiva is the study halls. And they're sitting all day and looks like they're lazy. Take them to a matzah baking. Wow, these guys can move.
And they whip into action. And actually, people can hear about that in detail on your. You did go into detail when we spoke about chametz and seor and matzah, and you talk exactly. about when you went and visited it. Did you work in that? I can't remember now.
I worked as a supervisor for a while.
The Pesach matzah factory.
I'm big and strong, so I was intimidating because we have to make sure the workers, you know, there were workers there who were not that observant. So we had to make sure that they work properly. So I was standing there, you know, wearing my suit and everything.
And a whip.
Scaring them. No, not a whip. But the whole idea was to keep an eye open on some of them.
Yeah, and they work hard, right? So
yeah, they work very hard. I like what people think. There used to be a joke in Europe that European Jews, you know, they get these ulcers and everything, but they don't work, which is just stupid. Mm. It's not true. Jews work very, very, very hard. By the way, that's that whole idea of Jews not working is basically originally from the Romans, because the Romans, for example, never had a day of rest, and they suddenly meet these Judeans, these Israelites, they have this day. Once a week, they don't work. Just I claim that Jews were lazy. Mm. But on the other hand, the Romans were even more lazy because they're the ones who had politics. They actually had politicians. You know?
All right. So there's the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox, the Hasidic. I have one more question. Actually, I have two questions, but let's do this one.
Actually, I have a few more things I can describe. This is the end of things. So really, inside the Hasidic movement, some of the most famous ones are, for example, Chabad, mm-hmm. Lubavitch, mm-hmm. which were students of the Baal HaTanya, the one who balanced them out. Sure. So they're very common amongst many areas, but they're very, very extreme about their beliefs. I mean, if you don't believe as they do, it's kind of like with them sometimes. Okay. I'm not a very big fan of Chabad, you can notice. Okay. Another very famous group is Breslev. Some of the Breslev that people notice, Breslev is a movement that's developed in a city called Breslau in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Their rabbi was an interesting character, very, very good psychologist. Very interesting. I've actually read some of his writings. He had a very, very good understanding of the human psyche, which is very, very interesting. Hmm. But maybe because he himself had some issues. But it doesn't mean that he was stupid or anything. He was actually considered to be a very intelligent man. Mm-hmm. So today, for example, you come to Jerusalem, you have these guys who, you know, they stop in the street, they put out music, and they start bouncing. That's a sect from the Breslau,
right.
for example. Those guys are very, very famous. Very, very famous. They all have they all try to grow very large peot, you know, yes. very large sidewalks and everything. Uh-huh. And other groups, I mean, for example, you have shapes of hats.
That's what I was going to ask about. That's one of the things
You have ones that wear like white stocking. They have these like short pants that look like they're from the 1700s. Yep. You have the ones who wear, you have the ones who wear very long pants, but they put their socks above it. These are all cultures. I mean, for example, the Machnovke Rebbe, the word Rebbe, so they don't really have rabbis, but it's not rabbi as if a Torah scholar. A Rebbe can be a Torah scholar, but also is like a spiritual leader, which is uh-huh. one of the differences. You don't go to the Rebbe to ask him a question in how to do something. You ask him more spiritual guidance. Mm-hmm. So the Machnovke Rebbe, for example, looks like a Cossack. I've met him face to face. He looks like a Cossack, which is basically Eastern European. I'm not even sure exactly how to call them. The Cossacks were a group inside the area of Russia, Ukraine, and they all wore large woolen hats, and they dressed in a certain way. And I remember I bumped into the Machnovke Rebbe in the middle of the street in the old city, and I look at him, and he looks stares back at me, and I look at him, and I'm like, what on earth are you wearing? You know? No, so I just politely said hello and carried on because I realized who he was.
Right.
And I go, and my friend says, why is he dressed like that? You know, it says, it's the Machnovke Rebbe. And I'm like, so what?
So there are some groups that are very particular about the way that they present themselves because they're identified via their presentation and their dress.
They're also trying to preserve the culture of Europe.
Sure.
They're basically trying to freeze things so they don't get absorbed into the modern age culture.
Which tradition has the big cool looking hat that looks like they're wearing a tie?
Oh, you mean the pizza top?
Yeah, what is the pizza top? The pizza top looks cool.
You mean the fur hat?
Yeah, the fur hat, right? It's big.
Okay, so the fur hat. So fur hat, there's different types. So, for example, ghoul wear a spodik, which is this big fur thing.
Yeah.
But the hat you're referring to is called a Steimer, and it's actually quite common amongst a lot of European Jews.
Uh-huh.
So you can see a Steimer in almost any Hasidic group. Is that there's some of them, for example, like Gur, which is considered one of the most powerful Hasidic groups, most influential, who wear this massive thing, huge. I mean, I've met people from Gur, and they wear these huge, huge fur hats.
Now, it's
not a sombrero. It's an insanely tall fur hat. Now, a lot of people wear synthetic these days because they don't want to hunt fox anymore and stuff like that. But it's very common amongst all Hasidic groups. Mm-hmm. They're different styles. But there are also, for example, here in Jerusalem, there are a lot of Litvish Jews. There's this whole German group that I know that wear Streimel as well, because it's just a custom of Europe. It became less and less amongst Western European Jews because it became the symbol that identifies the Hasidim.
Right.
But they wanted to avoid that, so they stopped wearing them. Yeah. But, you know, when you go, I mean, for example, one of the major Lithuanian rabbis in Jerusalem, Rabbi Eliashiv, he wears a Streimel, you know. But the hats themselves, I mean, again, for example, there were Hasidic people who wore a cylinder hat, like Heltzel with those very tall hats, if people know what I'm talking about, very tall black hats.
Yes.
People used to wear those. You know, so the hats most people wear today, I mean, Hasidim wear more the traditional. For example, a pizza top almost looks like a hat that belongs to the we call it pizza top, is it? But those hats really resemble the hats that, for example, the Amish wear. What the Amish do and what a lot of the Hasidim do is exactly the same. They're trying to freeze time in the way they dress. I mean, if you want, they can be a completely modern house. You know, they have everything besides a television. They can have a computer. They can have everything. Television is like a symbol of like the evil. You know, don't have a television at home.
Sure.
I won't have a television at home for other reasons. There's nothing to watch these days.
Sure.
But
to preserve their identity within their culture from which their ancestors have come, this is the way that they particularly want to display themselves in public, right? So they're identified.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Okay. And most of the Lithuanian Jews wear, you know, short suits as opposed to very long coats that Hasidim would wear. Litvish Jews would wear more of like a 1950s hat. Less something else. These round hats that look like something from like the 1920s, almost like a slightly larger version of a Charlie Chaplin hat, like almost like a bowler.
Like a bowler,
It looks almost like a bowler hat, but it's a bit taller. You know, it's trying to preserve. And really, you know, the main people are those factories in Hungary, for example, produce these hats solely for Israel. Very little of it actually goes to other countries.
Really,
mostly bought by Israelis and American Jews.
Interesting.
It's kind of funny. There's a few factories in it. There's one in Italy. There's one in Hungary. There's one in the U.S. And besides cinema most of the people who buy these hats are Jews, which is kind of funny.
Interesting.
The other thing, for example, goes on in the more about women is, for example, types of head covers.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, today it's become very, very popular for women to wear wigs of sorts.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Yeah,
some kind of a recognized head covering, right?
Yes, it's considered some kind of recognized head covering. I always ponder about it because, you know, you're going to cover your hair with some other hair because it's the highest quality.
It just seems exceptionally weird to me, but I don't...
You missed the point. You actually missed the point. So when you ask them about this, you know, today most of the women who wear... these wigs are either Chabad, because the Lubavitcher Rebbe said that it's better than the wigs they had there at that time, back in the 1950s, that looked like, you know, little piles of straw or something. They look really, really horrendous. They didn't really look like – they didn't make the woman look attractive.
Right.
So, for example, if you bump into a Lubavitch woman, they don't really wear these – or most of them don't really wear these really nice – they're called shaitels. these really nice wigs. But you, for example, you go into certain communities where they're a lot more modern, and the women wear these wigs. Some of them look like real hair. So there's an uproar about it now. A lot of rabbis are going against it, and it's changing. It's slowly changing. You know, I don't think that women have to cover their hair, but if you're really saying you have to cover your hair, why cover it with a wig that actually looks like real hair? Sometimes it even looks better than your actual hair.
Sure. Okay.
So by the way, a warning about this head covering thing. When you cover your hair for very long, the hair starts falling out.
Vitamin D, people, get some sunlight. All right.
Yeah, women should expose their hair to sunlight.
I have a question, and I think this is probably going to be our last one, but we spoke about Ashkenazi Jews. We didn't talk we didn't talk about Sephardic.
So there's not much to explain about the Sephardic Jews. A lot of this, you know, first of all, the word Sfaradim comes from the word Sfarad, which means Spain. North African Jews are just Jews. You know, there's not much I can explain because I don't come from those countries. But one, for example, you have what's called Eastern Jews, which are Jews who come from Persia, Iraq, etc. And there's a lot of culture, there's a lot of stuff you can read. The center of Judaism at one point was actually in Iraq, Persia, you know, for hundreds of years because of the Babylonian exile. Uh-huh. And even during the Second Temple period, there were two centers, which was Israel and Babylon. So that's a very, very interesting piece of history as well, which we'll talk about some other time. North African Jews, it's kind of interesting. Egyptian Jews have been there for eons, literally eons, basically from the times probably of Jeremiah or even maybe before that.
Sure.
You had the Jews of Elephantine, which had their own temple there for a while as well. And then you have, for example, Jews of Tunisia, which have probably been there from the Second Temple period as well.
Sure.
For example, in Carthage, also known as Carthago, there were Jews as well. By the way, Carthage or Carthago was actually a city built by Phoenicians, which left this area to North Africa. So we actually have responsive from a very, very early period from North Africa as well. What's a very specific and interesting group are the Moroccan Jews. A lot of the Moroccan Jews want to actually stand and say that they're Sfaradim, that they're Spanish. If you see a Moroccan Jew with blue eyes, they probably are Spanish. When the Jews in North Africa and specifically Morocco have been there for eons. There's actually, just before we go to Morocco, Tunisia, what's interesting, there's a small island off the coast of Tunisia called called Djerba. What's interesting about the Jewish village in Djerba is it's a village only of Kohanim, only of people from the line of Aaron. No one else lived there.
There's a whole village of Kohanim.
Just Kohanim. Yeah. And I actually had a friend from there, and he told me this really funny story. He said that his grandfather, when they went to the priestly blessing, there was no one there. They go up to where the Torah scroll is, where the Aron Kodesh, the Ark, where the Torah scroll is, and there's no one standing in the synagogue. It's only priests blessing whatever. So they said that the women were the ones answering to, you know, answering amen to every part of the blessing. Which is kind of, I say laughing. So I have a friend, I had a friend from high school who was a Djerbaï. We should call them a person from Djerba, Djerbaï. So they're a very interesting group. And the Moroccan Jews, for example, a lot of them see themselves as Spanish Jews, but they're not. They've been there also for a very long while. But when the Spanish Jews were expelled from Spain and Portugal, they actually gave them a special name. They called them the Franks, the Franquistim.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, you have, I for example, know this lady who's from North Africa. Her name is Franco, and she does not.
Her first name or her surname?
Her surname was Franco. And I actually met her, she's married to a very good friend of mine, and she has blue eyes and does not look anything like the rest of the Moroccan Jews.
Wow.
And I asked her, is your family from Spain? And she said, we are. We are originally from Spain. And they actually have relatives who still speak Ladino, which is the Spanish, basically the Yiddish of Spain.
Yeah, I was about to say this. So it's kind of that morphing of Hebrew and Spanish. And what's exactly. What's it called?
It's called Ladino.
Ladino, as opposed to Yiddish, which is a combination of German and Hebrew, if you like.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you also have Jewish Arabic. So, for example, Moroccan Jews speak a dialect of Arabic that most Arabs don't really understand because it's kind of weird. It's very different. I mean, when I hear Moroccan Jews speaking Moroccan Arabic, I don't identify anything, and I know a bit of Arabic.
Sure.
So there were groups inside North Africa were Franks, and they were called Franks because of the blue eyes, because they identified the Europeans as being blue-eyed.
Oh, I see.
A lot of them actually, for example, moved to Europe. One of the claims of my father was that our family, from my grandmother's side, from his mother's side, came from Spain, and they left with the Muslims when the Christians came, and they started traveling into Europe. So there's also a lot of European Jews who are descended from Spain. Specifically, for example, Dutch Jews are from Spanish descent. There's Spanish Portuguese from Spain. There's Spanish Portuguese from Spain and Portugal who live in Amsterdam. There's a synagogue, for example, in Amsterdam, which is a Spanish Portuguese synagogue. There's a synagogue in London, which is a Spanish Portuguese synagogue. The first Jews to return to England were Spanish Portuguese.
Very interesting.
So Jews really dwelt mostly in Europe and anywhere around the Mediterranean, and but didn't really spread. But you also have groups, for example, you got Chinese Jews who were Persian Jews who traveled just to the east as merchants, and they reached China and they settled there. You have the Beta Israel, which are Indian Jews. And what's interesting about these groups, none of them have all the law. The ones from China, the one from Beta Israel, they don't have all the law. Today, we also treat the Ethiopians as descendants of Israel. Mm. We treat them as Israelites. Mm-hmm. And they never had an oral law as well, which is very, very interesting. Mm. But in general, you know, really Jews in South Africa, the Jews in South Africa today, for example, we're just talking about, you know, Jews who traveled from Europe to South Africa. In Australia and New Zealand, for example, a lot of Holocaust survivors went to Australia and New Zealand, you know, as one example.
Yes.
And then you also have, you know, the Jewry of America, which is one of the greater
populations of the world Jewry is in the States, and particularly, of course, we know about New York. And so it's a wide and varying spectrum. How are we going to wrap this up?
So I want to say one last thing. The last group we didn't speak about is actually the Jews of South America. And the South American there are groups of people in South America who left Spain to go to the New World, and there are a lot of people in Mexico, in Uruguay, in wherever you want. There are a lot of people
in Costa Rica, in Brazil.
Exactly. A lot of these people are descendants of Jews, and they're basically Jews who hid from the Inquisition. There are a lot of people. You should check this out. If your family's from South America and you have some kind of an inclination towards Judaism, towards the Torah, check very well into your family genealogy. Mm. You'll be surprised what you'll find. I've met people from the Spanish world of South America who discovered that they were falsely converted into Christianity and now are returning. So to wrap this up, Judaism, as diverse as it might be, I mean, you know, being Jewish, as diverse as it might be, it's still actually pretty unified, which is kind of surprising.
Sure.
It's extremely unified.
So
any final words for John O'Vondor?
Well, while you're talking, I'm just thinking, you know, I know that a lot of people, because you mentioned South America, and I'm just having a look at some of the statistics of the website, and I know that there are people listening in Mexico, there's people listening in Brazil, there are people listening in Costa Rica. So good day to you guys, and it's marvelous to have your company as well. And to all of the Jewry around the world that listen to Truth to You, thank you for listening. And thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo, for giving us a really quick, broad, in a nutshell, clarification of the Jews and their traditions, their customs, the way that they look and how they vary around the world, and a little bit of the history of that as well, my friend. Thank you once again.
You're welcome. And I hope I haven't bored anyone in this one.
It's a pleasure to have you back on the program. And again, it is Hebrew in Israel. Go to Facebook, get on Hebrew in Israel, like the page and engage in the comments. And of course, if you would like, once again, Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, it is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. And in the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word, because that's what unites us, right, Yod? Amen. The Torah. Shalom.